Good morning, everyone. Everyone awake and ready?
Awake and ready.
Great. Let us go within. We're used to focusing on the things of this world, the things of the senses, how our mind normally runs. But let us, for the moment, withdraw from all of that. Withdraw from the world and its worries and concerns. Withdraw from the senses and draw the consciousness into the spine and into the higher regions of the brain. Reverse the flow and feel the life force being concentrated within your spine and your brain. Sense there the centers opening, the heart center opening in love. The sixth center opening in enlightened thought. And the crown chakra at the top of the head opening into the divine consciousness where there is only one without a second, without reference to anything else, just pure, unalloyed spirit. And in that concentrated, open, awakened state, there we can properly worship Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, and feel our oneness with the same. In that spirit, let us pray, O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother,
Beloved
Jesus Christ,
Blessed
Master, Saints and sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only King.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
God, that it's rather unfair that he has his chant like that, and I'm so filled with his love and his bliss that then I'm expected to do something, actually. But we'll do our best. Reading from Master's commentary on the Sermon on the Mount. From Matthew 5:7, Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Mercy is a sort of fatherly heartache for the deficiency in child souls. The wise alone can really be merciful, for they look upon all wrongdoers as children who deserve sympathy, forgiveness, help, and guidance. Mercy is useless unless the fatherly heartache melts and expresses itself in offering forgiveness and actual spiritual help in eliminating the error in the individual. The morally weak but willing to be good, the real sinner, the greatest transgressor against his own happiness, and the spiritually ignorant, should obtain merciful help from the wise. Besides these, the physically decrepit and the mentally and spiritually weak all need merciful help from souls that are capable of rendering merciful help. Mercy denotes the capacity for being helpful. Therefore, only developed or qualified souls can be practically and mercifully useful. Souls who continuously develop themselves in every way and mercifully feel the lack of all-around development in others surely will melt the heart of God with compassionate sympathy and obtain his unending and helpful mercy. In other words, You must be merciful to yourself by making yourself spiritually qualified, and must also be merciful to other deluded children of God if you want to receive divine mercy. This last week we met up at Loon Lake for the retreat, and we focused upon forgiveness. And when you think about it, you really can't have mercy for others unless you have forgiveness first in your own heart. Forgiveness for what others have transgressed against you, and also forgiveness for yourself for having committed transgressions. As long as you hold a grudge, as long as there is a spirit, an emotional charge on anything from the past that anybody has done to you or that you have done to anybody else, you cannot be truly merciful. You cannot have this heavenly Father's type of compassion for erring children. You will be caught up in the emotional tangles that do not allow you to see clearly. You know, in debate, they teach you how to take either side of an argument, and oftentimes they will have people study a particular topic, and it's not until the last moment that they know whether they're going to argue one side or the other. And that you must present either side in a convincing kind of a way. You must know what each side has. The advantage that a spiritually illumined person has is they know all sides of an argument. They know what it's like to err. They know what it's like to be in ignorance. They know what it is like to be consumed by some object that they want and that they are unwilling to relinquish. They know what the pain is when that object is either gained or lost, and even in the gaining of it, that ultimately it is such a cost that it separates the individual soul from the universal soul. And therefore, there will always be suffering. This cannot be avoided. As long as you live in a state of separation, no matter what you attain in this world, you will always find that suffering. You will always be in a state of misery. There once was a story of a man who was gardening, and he was a Brahmin. And so he was supposed to be of the highest nature, and he carefully cultivated his garden, and he had fruit trees, and he had vegetables, and he so lovingly went after everything. And one day, a cow broke down the fence and came in and started munching his way to fullness through his garden. The Brahmin became enraged at this. He had put in so much work, and to see this cow destroying his garden, and in his rage, he committed what in India is a crime beyond crimes. He killed the cow. Well, he was horrified at what he had done. And so when other people came and said, "Oh, this dead cow, you killed it?" He says, no, I didn't kill it. He said that, you know, who am I that I could kill anything? And that actually it was my hand that did it, but Indra is in charge of hands, so goes the theology around it. So it was Indra's fault that he did it, that this happened. Well, the people maybe grumblingly accepted this, but one day Indra came to know about this assignment of blame, and so he disguised himself as an old Brahmin, and he came into town, and then he came to this Brahmin's house and his garden. And he stood there admiring at the garden, which has been all put to rights by this time. And Indra, in the disguised Brahmin, said to this householder Brahmin, he says, "What a beautiful garden you have. Who created this garden?" "Oh, I did," the man said very proudly. He says, "Oh, look at the rows. They're all straight, and they're so beautifully kept and weeded. Who takes care of all of that?" And the man proudly proclaimed, "I did all of that. I did. This is my garden. Oh, the fruit must taste so good, and the vegetables must be so good. And you've done all of this, have you?" "Oh, yes, I've done every bit of it." And then Indra took off his disguise and he stood there and he says, really? He says, when you take credit for all of this, is it really right for you to put the blame on me for what you did? And the man was humbled and ashamed at what he had done. It's an interesting thing how much we try to protect this ego. When something bad happens, how quickly the mind races to how we can put the blame on someone else or how we can somehow hide the thing that happened. It's an interesting thing in the story of Adam and Eve that the first thing they did in biting into the tree of knowledge of good and evil was that they hid from God. And picturesquely, God is shown as walking through the garden and looking for his dear children, and he couldn't find them. He found them hiding. That had never happened before. They had walked in easy communion one with another before this time. Why are you hiding, my children? Because we are afraid and we are ashamed. That is the tree of duality, the knowledge of duality, of good and evil, high and low, in and out, all the different opposites are now known to the mind, and the mind projects itself into this objectivity. And as a result of that, it becomes entwined and embroiled in all duality. This is the source of everything that has gone wrong. This is the source of the ego nature, the ego consciousness. And so in order to rectify that, we need to draw the mind back in, but it's not such an easy thing to do. It's lovely to see that since Master's coming to this West, that there has been so much that is now commonplace known about Hindu culture and about yoga. Now there is yoga studio in almost any town that you go to. There is knowledge around words and different concepts that yoga has brought to us, karma, reincarnation, and so on. We saw a lovingly portrayed depiction of the Ramayana that's been turned into a play and has debuted here in Seattle. And it's not perfect, perhaps, but you can tell that the people that did it with good intentions all the way through. And there's a story from the Ramayana, and it goes like this. There's a great battle taking place. It's a battle of good against evil, and Rama has arrived with all the monkeys and the bears, and they're doing battle with these terrible Rakshasas. They are evil ones. And the battle is taking place, and it's really tough days at times. And on this particular day, the monkeys are being beat back by these Rakshasas. And so they're retreating, and some of them are being killed, and they're retreating, and it's not going well for them. And so Rama, in his omniscience, is looking upon this and sees what needs to be done. And so he has a divine power, and in that divine power, he makes all the different combatants on both sides to see each other as Rama. And so when the monkeys see each other as Rama, they're overjoyed with and thrilled with love and devotion, and they start hugging each other and celebrating each other because each one sees the other as Rama. And they so love and revere Rama that they are just ecstatic in the love. Well, on the other side is the Rakshasas, and they have a different relationship with Rama. Rama is their enemy, and they hate him. And so once they start seeing each other as Ram, they begin to kill each other. And they slaughter each other off, and thereby the monkeys are able to win the day because of their own reaction of the universal image that is being seen one within another. And so this is the fruits of our own view of this universe, isn't it? That when we see everything as God, then we can embrace everything that is, even those who are different from us, even those who entertain different thoughts, have different theories, behave perhaps as scoundrels and in bad ways. When you see from this universal vision, when your mind is purified, you are able to see yourself in every person that you meet, in every situation that you are in. Now, it does not mean that everything that you see leads to the highest. Eventually it does, but some leads to suffering, and you know it. You see somebody who is cultivating unlovely habits. And as a result of what they are doing, you know that they will come into a period of suffering. And they may even get away with it from a worldly standpoint. They may excel. They may get rewarded for what they are doing. But when you see, and this could be irritating to you, it could be maddening to you, that seemingly somebody who is adharmic, going against the rules of Dharma, going against the rules of what is right, seemingly is prospering as a result. But when you see it from a long distance view of the soul, and seeing over lifetimes and millennia, you know that there is no getting away from it, and that the person who is doing this is sowing seeds of evil that he will have to reap the fruit of what he has sown. It's another interesting element of the Ramayana, in that Brahma gives a gift to Ravana, who is a great evil one, and so does Shiva, gives him weapons. And they know that Shiva, when he gives the weapon to him that makes him very, even more powerful than before, he knows that he is evil. But he knows that the greater the weapons he has, the faster the evil will bring upon the rebound of karma onto him, and will result in his temporary destruction, and ideally will release him from these negative habits. So you see, what God does sometimes seems inscrutable from a human standpoint. It seems like those who do wrong prosper, those who do not sometimes suffer. And that God is behind every single thing. Every single thing that you do, every single thing that you think, every single action that you take, and word that you speak, it all goes out and it sows a seed. And you will reap that. Sometimes people have sown seeds of goodness in the past, but they are seduced because they have this samskara, they have this tendency deep in their unconscious mind, and they get around certain people or situations, and it's like fertilizer. It's like Miracle-Gro that acts on the seed, and suddenly this evil tendency takes over. We see that in our own children sometimes. They're so sweet and innocent, and they awaken such love. And then at certain stages in their life, they turn into these little devilkins. And it can be shocking. Where does this come from? Why do they act in this way? And they have this seed of karma inside of them, and it's not until that point that it's triggered. And that is their test. It is their test to overcome whatever it is that has been triggered in them. It is also our test to stand firm in the light, to stand firm in what is good, but also to see that God is behind the mask, that God is behind the mask, that what they are doing will not lead to goodness. And so as parents, we have to guide them, and we do our best to bring them into the light and to correct them when they are needed. And these are wonderful plays, because it reinforces in our own minds the clarity around what is right and what is good and what leads us higher. But we also see as papacies. And that is, sometimes the worst evildoers will be propelled to the light faster than those who are of medium kind of intensity around finding God. So we oftentimes see in the lives of saints that their earlier lives were not good. The writer of the Ramayana, Valmiki, he was a terrible man in his life previous to meeting Narada. And Narada, when he met him, changed his life completely. And as evil as he had been before, he is absolutely determined to go beyond the limitations of this world. So when you see this play in that way, when you see somebody who has these unlovely characteristics, whether you know them in your own personal life or they're somebody that you see through television or magazines or different portrayals, look deeper and see there that the ultimate cause and effect that they are sowing will ultimately bring them into the light. And as many mistakes and as error-torn as they are in this life, they will have to return one day back into the divine light. And when they do, they have to face everything that they have done, everything that they have done in this life. You know, I have experienced this in my own interior life, and God has shown me what an exacting master karma is. Because you see the law of cause and effect acted out again and again. And it may seem unfair to us. Why should I have to suffer for what I did in a previous lifetime? And yet, when we see the totality of the soul, we see that it is perfect. Karma is not there to punish us. Karma is there to awaken us. When we can do something to somebody else, I once had a boss who told me that he thought that you had to lie and even to cheat in order to make it in business. And we had such an argument about it. We were on a business trip at the time. And he got in an airplane and flew the rest of the way home. And I drove the rest of the way home. Because he is so upset. Because I did not agree with him. And I did not agree with the business practices. And that was, needless to say, the severance of our business relationship with each other. But I did not accept it then, and I don't accept it now. The very best who are in business, they do have ethics. They do go according. You know, it's a wonderful story that Mother once told, that J.C. Penney, who started the J.C. Penney stores, that originally when he started the business, he called it the Golden Rule Store, because he wanted everyone who walked in through the door for the clerks or management or whoever it was working for the business to treat that individual walking through the door just as they themselves would want to be treated. And so it's the Golden Rule Store, and it prospered and it grew. And this was the kind of attitude that he had. When we see the world being run by Dharma, being run by what is right, then we will see this world turn into a heaven on earth. Now that may seem a long ways away to you, but really it's not. You think about each individual living up to the highest light that they know in this moment. Living up to the highest light that they know in this moment. It's not that hard. It's not that far away. Just think of every person doing that. They may not always make it. When we're trying to change ourselves, when we're trying to change a habit, we do make mistakes. And that's one of the things, when you are merciful towards this world, you understand that even when somebody is trying their best, that they may not measure up, they may not do it perfectly. And most of all, you understand that about yourself. Now, this is not excuse making, but it is understanding, and it just gives you a double determination to get back in there and do it right, to not make a mistake again, to see where the error crept in, to recreate that moment and see yourself doing it differently. Now, this journey back to God is not easy. I recently met somebody who was unacquainted with the spiritual path. In large part, they were a good person and they tried to be a good person. They didn't meditate. But a year ago, they suddenly had an awakening of the Kundalini. Now, this individual, she's a medical doctor, a wonderful person, but she was completely at a loss to explain what was going on inside, and it was a true awakening. Sometimes I meet people, and they say, oh, I'm having this Kundalini, this and that, and it's nothing of the sort. But in her case, it is. And she was in real trouble. Because unless you know how to guide yourself through it, how to focus your mind, how to interreact, and what is going on, you would believe that you're going insane. Now, it's an interesting difference between spiritual science and physical science, because in physical science, oftentimes you will hear that thought is a product of the brain. Consciousness is a product of the brain. Spiritual science says just the opposite. Brain is ultimately a product of consciousness and thought. And so now brain is an instrument through which thought and consciousness operates. Now, if the instrument is broken, for instance, if you have a stroke or if you have Alzheimer's or some form of dementia, some other form of where the brain is not operating correctly, pure consciousness and pure thought cannot operate through that brain, you see, because it is like having something that if you had a screwdriver or a wrench or something and it was broken and you were trying to make it work, it wouldn't work properly. And even so with the brain. But that is what leads the person to think, oh, well, then thought and consciousness is a product of the brain, because if the brain is broken, then you can't have that thought. You can't have that consciousness. But this just simply is not so. I love the story that Larry tells of being a young boy looking at the trees when the wind blew through them and seeing these huge limbs waving, so to speak, as the wind was blowing through them. And in his mind, the law of cause and effect was that the trees were moving their branches and they were creating the wind. It's an interesting way of looking at it, isn't it? Now, we learn that that's not the law of cause and effect, but it makes total sense when you think about it from that perspective and if you don't know anything better. So physical science has taken that stand. But we know that consciousness is pre-existent to the body and that it exists after the body. And the deeper you go into this path, the deeper you go into truth, you realize that you come to know that that's absolutely true. And so this Kundalini force is a very specific form of life energy. And it, so to speak, resides at the base of the spine. And when it's released, when it's unleashed, it has a great purpose. And it comes through the spine. And it triggers all the chakras, all the consciousness centers along the spine. And each one of those chakras has a polarity, has a positive and a negative. And so you feel like the Christ who is on the cross, and on one side is the good thief and on the other side is the bad thief. And the one thief, the bad thief, is derisive, mocking of the Christ and his experience, not believing in heaven or in afterlife. And the other thief is saying, Lord, take me with you when you enter into your kingdom. Those are the good tendencies, the positive polarity. And so each one are triggered, and each one, even the good and the positive, even the positive is a thief, because it's limited in consciousness. It's not the full God consciousness. It's attracted toward the good and the light, but it's not the fullness, it's not the allness of it. So even that must be transcended. But those good positives are lifted up and return into divine consciousness from whence it came. The evil consciousness is thrown into the flame and is consumed and it disappears. It no longer is there. When you have achieved full and complete emancipation, you are no longer between these two opposites. But when you're in the upward ascension, it seems as if these opposites become more accentuated. You think you're going to freedom, but actually getting there is a real trial, is a real test. Through much of my life, I couldn't say that I lived with much great fear or terror. I had an underlying anxiety, but that's a different kind of a thing. And I had a negative self-image of myself. I felt like I was responsible for everything, especially if it was bad, not anything good. But when I was going up through this ascension, I had such fear triggered inside of me, such fear, I can't tell you how much, and also anger. And before I would have told you, I'm just not an angry person, I don't feel it. But during this experience, I did. It was a full out-and-out rage. Papa described that one time as he was chanting Ram Nam and wandering through the jungles. And suddenly he was just gripped in this rage, and he fell down onto the ground, and it was swimming as if he was swimming in this dirt and in this rage. And it was getting released. It was getting released as he was purifying the mind, and it had to be released. He even talked about, not commonly known, but that when he and Mataji were attacked at the first ashram that they established, that was a planned assault, and it was to drive them away. And so Papa held, because Mataji's back had been severely injured. There are many, many days where she just had to lie down on the pavement, the concrete, and just wait until her back would quit spasming and hurting. And that was a lifelong thing for her. Her back never completely healed from that, and she had pain from it. Papa also held something against the two men that came and attacked them, and maybe they would have done worse, except that they had called out loudly, Ram, Ram, Ram. Papa first, then Mataji, and when they did, these men ran away. But Papa held in anger, and even after he was so fully realized, he still had that anger, and he said he did not go completely over the top, all the way to complete realization, until years later when this man came back to one of the two men, came back to the ashram, and he told them what he had done, and he was very sorry for it. And at that point, Papa could let it go. And until then, he still had that anger inside of him. This is a very, very exacting path that we follow. There's no fooling it. And there's no fooling God or ourselves, ultimately. So to be merciful, you see, is to understand exactly where somebody is coming. In order to do that, we have to forgive ourselves and we have to forgive others. Now, forgiveness, we're told the word forgiveness. We spent 3 days working on forgiveness. We're told to forgive, but oftentimes we don't know. And ultimately, forgiveness and lack of forgiveness is about attachment. And when we're attached that the world should look in a certain way, that people should act in a certain way, and then they don't, and we feel that emotional charge, we feel that hurt, we feel that anger, then we have entered into a relationship with that individual. And we tie ourselves to them, particularly when we want revenge. From a human standpoint, that's a natural thing to do. We want to see somebody else get theirs if they've done something to us or somebody else. And yet, in the Old Testament it says that revenge is mine, saith the Lord. That is God's business. And when you really understand this life, you understand that God will see to it that this individual will have to go through whatever experiences they have to in order to release themselves from what they have once done. Otherwise, it resides in the subconscious mind. And because of that, the law of attraction will draw circumstances to us that we will have to be the recipient of whatever it is that we have given out. There is a saying, it says, whenever you speak, make sure your words are sweet, just in case you have to eat them. And isn't this the truth? And at the very least, they should be true. They should be true, the words that we speak. Just give yourself an assignment to always speak the truth. That in itself can be a full-time sadhana, whether you are talking to somebody else or to yourself. Do you elucidate only the truth? Or do you obfuscate? Do you round the edges? Do you gild it a little bit so that you don't look in such a bad light? Are you willing to take things out? Master said that when his guru, Sri Yukteswar, would take out ideas, he would put it on an antiseptic table, and he would be able to dissect it with his intuitive mind. Now, we all have a reasoning mind, and it has a certain function in this world. But our intuition comes from that still, small voice. And when we listen to that, and we still the mind, see, if we don't have forgiveness and mercy in our heart, we cannot still the mind. Those are emotional charges that will disturb the mind, disrupt it. They're like electrical charges that are keep getting sent out in waves, and they disturb us. We can't still the mind completely as long as we hold anything against anybody else or ourselves. You notice that I keep linking those two things. Sometimes we can actually think that it is humility that we think badly of ourselves, that we keep rehearsing all the bad things that we did. But really, it's just the other side of the ego coin where we're also always disturbed by somebody else. And we say, well, I don't hold anything about anybody else. And yet we cannot forgive ourselves. We must forgive ourselves. We must let go. We must see ourselves through the vision and the eyes of God, that we are His children, that even when we make mistakes, we are still His children. As Mother said when she met Mother Teresa of Calcutta, she says, Mother, I don't have any sinners in our group. And she said that Mother Teresa of Calcutta looked a little startled by this. And she said, they are all God's kids. Some of them are naughty and some of them are good, but they're all God's children. See, this is looking at the world as God looks at the world. God is not overwhelmed by anything that we do. In my capacity, both as a counselor and as a minister, people bring many things to me. And I remember when people really were going to bring up something to me that was very, very difficult for them to say. And finally, they would blurt it out, whatever it is. And usually, I would just think to myself, is that it? Is that the worst you got? You've been struggling about bringing this out in the open for so long? What a relief when we do. We can begin to let it go. One of the values that I think of when we come together in these classes and different people talk and they talk about their own experiences. And they talk about difficulties that they've had. They've talked about how they've been disappointed, that they've come up short of the goal and so forth. And it's not that we encourage that kind of thing, but we understand it. And other people, when they hear it, they go, oh my God, I thought I was the only one. I thought I was the worst one, and everyone else were just these perfect angels. Mother said that one time somebody from out of town said, but Mother, here in Seattle you have all these perfect angels. And she laughed. And she thought, oh, what you don't know. You know, we should develop a little sense of humor about ourselves, about our journey on the path. We need to have the long-term view. Now, this is, again, not excuse-making, and it's not that we get lackadaisical, because when we see the whole picture, we see what's suffering that we create both for ourselves and other people when we fall short of the goal. It's serious business from that standpoint. But also, we should have sown in there compassion, mercy, understanding, and an increased determination that we should really learn the lesson. I think Swami Satchidananda said something very profound when he said, anytime that you see that you have made an error, you can trace it back and you can see that you have not had proper intensity of your spiritual practice. So when we fall short of the goal, then let us just return with increased determination, knowing how subtle and how quick the mind is to get in there and to take us in the wrong direction. It's all about recovery, recovery, recovery. And when you have this mercy with yourself, then you can feel that God is working inside of you. You know, you would not have any desire to know God, to see God, unless God's grace was already operating inside of you. And I know from my own experience that the closer you get to the goal, oftentimes the further you feel away from it, because you are coming up against those oppositional forces as you never have before. And there are many times when I sat down to do my Kriya and to meditate, I didn't want to be there. I wanted to be anywhere than there. Why do we have so much difficulty with that, with Kriya? It's because it symbolically and practically represents our going back to God, our closeness to God, our intimacy with God. God is so intimate that He's moving in your spine and your brain, deep in your soul, awakening Himself. And so the very method that we have been given, it's the very thing that we want to avoid, that we want to stay away from. This is not a sign that we're not on the path. Only if we give in to it and stay away, that's what is a symbol of not being on the path. But the fact that these repulsions come up, that this polarization against God, against leading the life that we know that we should, this means that we're right on the path, not far from it. When we are able to be merciful towards one and all, then we may obtain mercy. And so look deep within yourself. Is there anyone or anything that you just cannot let go of, that still holds an emotional charge? And what's important here is to separate out your values from the incident. You're not saying what that person or yourself did was right. You're just understanding that that's how life goes. And if anything, you're more determined to do what is right more than ever before. Some people are great examples of what to do. Other people are also great examples, but they are examples of what not to do. And we can learn from them as well. We can see our own face in theirs. We can see a reflection. And we can point to ourselves and say, now listen, take a good look at this. And particularly if you have a strong emotional reaction, it may come from compassion. But true compassion will always be connected with God and will have understanding in it. It's not approval, but it is understanding. And it increases our determination to lead a better life and to serve and to serve. Serve everyone that you know in the way that God directs you. And if you just want to avoid somebody, think about how you can serve them. Think about how God can manifest the light within you so you can be the example of what you would like that individual to be. Now, this doesn't mean that you have to deliberately put yourself in their sphere. But if God puts you in this sphere, how do you interact with them? Do you give them all the power? You focus your whole attention on them? Or do you go deep inside and you say, God, I want your light to grow here. You guide and direct my mind so that whatever I do, whatever I speak, whatever I think is perfectly attuned with you. I'm not going to give this individual more power than I give you. And that's what we do when we become so obsessed with what another person is doing. If they are behaving badly, seek within yourself to awaken the light so that it is more powerful than whatever negativity is being broadcast by another. No individual is more powerful than you in God. And if you're giving them that power, you're giving them too much, and you're worshiping the evil that is in them instead of the God that is within yourself. And that is your fault. That is your doing. And so to create that determination more than ever to live in that light. And then to be merciful, that's not approval. But I understand, and I understand what this person is doing will eventually boomerang back on them, and I won't want to be around there when that happens. Because it will not be pleasant. It will not be easy. You know, there are those who have the privilege of meeting a true master, a true spiritual guru. And because they don't value it properly, they let it go. They let it go. But when the time comes, when they really need that, and it's not as if we don't, there's not a time when we don't need it, but there are particular times when we really need it. It won't come so easily. That's one of the things that God showed me about Gopi Krishna, who wrote some books on the Kundalini. And here he was in India. He had the awakening of the Kundalini force, and he could not find anybody who had any practical knowledge about it, who could really help him and to help him understand it. So he had to go through so much of it alone. And what God told me is that he had divorced himself from his guru. And as a result, he had to go through so much of this alone. But if he could have known it, he would have known that his guru was silently, invisibly supporting him and loving him in this great awakening, and that he was never truly alone. But you see, what he had put into motion had to bear results. And so he was not knowledgeable of it. There's a very interesting retelling of the story. Master told the story in one way, and I heard this story told another way. But when Babaji came to Sri Yukteswar and to thank him for writing the book, The Holy Science, and that when Sri Yukteswar came back, that Babaji later on said that your vibration was so excited it literally blew me away. And the retelling of the story, which I thought was interesting, which was Babaji said, you were in such an excited state that you could no longer see me. Both have interesting meanings to it. Both may be true. But just think, God being all around us, and we don't see him. We literally live in an ocean of bliss. But how much do we experience that? We live in an ocean of light. Now, it's not something necessarily to be seen with these two eyes or known through tactile senses. But I think that one of the biggest surprises for me in the spiritual path is how profoundly powerful these experiences are, that are more convincing than anything that we get through the senses. They're not so ephemeral that we just can barely put our hands on it. They're powerful. And they're profound and they're life-changing. We don't have to guess at them. And if we're not having these, in all likelihood, we're staying on the surface. We're not going deeper. And we must challenge ourselves. And when we do, we will enter into these higher states and know God. We will understand that all souls are on the path, whether they realize it or not. And that some souls are making steps in the positive direction, and I love that when I see it. And other souls seem to be running in the opposite direction, but they too will know God. The question is just how long until that day comes? And why would we sentence ourselves even to a day of separation? Once you realize God and you know God, you wonder, why did I ever hesitate? Why did I ever think anything else competed with this or was more important with it than this? And you shake your head at yourself, but you have mercy on yourself. Because now you know that God is all and all in all. And this makes all the difference. Will you please pray with me? Oh, Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet and surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of Thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with Thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. Bow to the light within you.